Welcome to the Testimony Podcast, people of faith telling the stories that matter from their lives. I'm your host, Andrew Chamberlain, and I'm delighted that you can join us for this conversation. You can subscribe to the Testimony Podcast on all of the major podcast distributors and follow us on Twitter at TestimonyCast and Instagram at TestimonyPodcast. And welcome to episode 9 of the Testimony Podcast. My guest for this episode is a charity worker, historian, and fantasy writer. But before I introduce him, let me ask you a question. Have you ever had to wait for something, like for a really long time? Have you ever had to wait for a promise from God to be fulfilled? It's hard, isn't it, being patient and waiting for God to do something that we hope he will do. And sometimes it can get really hard and we can lose heart. As a young person, my guest felt God's call to be a writer, and he believed that call, and he determined that he would honour God with his writing. I think there's an important lesson in that for all of us. What are we called to? What are you called to? Are you an artist, a painter, a dancer, an actor, a writer, a clothing designer? Whatever your talent, whatever your art, you can give it to God. You can commit it to God, and he will bless you in it. And I've found, especially for those who engage in the arts, there can sometimes be a great stretch of time when you feel that your art is like a seed falling on fallow ground. Nothing seems to happen. Nothing seems to return to you. Proverbs chapter 16 verse 3 says, "Commit to the Lord whatever you do, and he will establish your plans." Now, I don't think that means that God will do just whatever we want him to do. He is God. He's not our servant. But I do think it means that if we commit all of our work, all of our art, all of our efforts wholly to God and submit those things to him and yield to his will and his agenda, he will establish what we do and it will succeed on his terms. Part of the challenge of that is that it puts God in charge of what we do, in charge of the hopes and dreams that we have for the art that we create and the outcomes from it. But that is where we find freedom, in that submission to his will. We can give our art, the best of our art, to God. We can and should hold on to the promises he gives us in that. And we shouldn't give up on our dreams too early. And submitting your art to God is not giving up on your art. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's allowing him to release it under his will. And I was reminded of all these truths in the conversation with my guest for this episode. His name is Michael J. Harvey, and he is a fantasy writer and author of the Auron Amula series. And Michael has earned the right to talk about this because he had to wait 17 years for his work to be published. He didn't give up on his dreams over that time. Rather, he held on to the promises that he felt God gave him, and he continued to commit his art to God. This is
his story. So, Michael, welcome to the Testimony Podcast. It's great to have you as our guest today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here.
So I wanted to start by just giving you an opportunity to introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about your background, your history, what you get up to now.
Sure. So my name is Michael J. Harvey. I'm a published author and a writer. I'm based in Cambridge, where I've been living for the last 11 years. I work full-time in marketing in the charity sector. But my first love is writing, and that's what I would do full time if I could, and hopefully we'll be able to at some point in the near future. Yeah, I became a published author a year ago, and I've just published my third book. So I've actually published three books in just the last year to get my epic fantasy trilogy, Auron Amula, fully published, which is fantastic. And now, in as much time as my lovely wife Lucy and my two small boys Ethan and Luke will allow, I'm working on the sequel, which involves a lot of writing, a lot of map drawing, and lots of world building.
Okay. And can you tell us what brought you to Cambridge? You said you moved about 11 years ago, I think. So what brought you to Cambridge then in the first place?
I met my wife at university in Leicester, and it was a real question mark what we would do after that. So we got married after university. And, you know, I had a conversation with a tutor at Leicester who'd said, if you want to continue studying history, and I really think you should, then Cambridge is the place to do it. I remember walking home and just saying to God, look, if you want me to study in Cambridge, then please give me a clear sign. And lo and behold, that's what came along. You know, the next time I spoke to that tutor, he very much bent the rules to tell me that I'd done so well in my exams that it would be a crime if I didn't go on to do my master's. So I felt that was a pretty clear sign from God. So we up sticks to Cambridge. Yeah, as newlyweds, we didn't know anyone there. It was a real step of faith. Yeah. But God has been faithful and established us here. And we've never looked back.
So you came to Cambridge, did your master's. What period in history did you work on then particularly?
So I love all history, but particularly medieval history. One of the reasons I went to Leicester was because they allowed me to study ancient and modern history alongside each other in twin tracks. And I then specialised by looking at late Anglo-Saxon and Carolingian history, doing an MPhil at Cambridge. Mm. So I love medieval history, and I draw on that a lot in what I write.
Mm, I was just thinking as you were saying that probably there's some pretty fertile ground there, but lots of rich sources for some of the things that you write. We'll come on to talk about some of your writing in a minute. Exactly. But I want to explore with you a little bit further your life, and wondered if you could tell us perhaps one or two stories from your life where you've sensed God's companionship and presence very specifically. And it might be through a journey to faith and that, or it might be through perhaps a very particular challenge that you had in your life, some difficulty that you had to face and God was with you in it. So, yeah, I wonder if you could tell us just one or two stories from your life there where God's been with you.
Sure. Well, I grew up in a Christian family, definitely benefited from a legacy of faith on the part of my parents, and I've been to church all my life. But I remember that it didn't really become real for me until I was age 12. And I was at one of the new wine festivals. And I remember vividly coming back from one of the youth group meetings, back to the tent, and just being overwhelmed by a sudden and inexplicable emotion. And just found myself sobbing in the tent. And I just didn't understand what was happening. But I know now, looking back, that it was my first encounter with the Holy Spirit. And it was really powerful. And thankfully, I had my parents nearby to help me understand what was going on. And just felt such a sense of acceptance and just the reality of God's presence in a way I hadn't before. It suddenly became real at a heart level, not just at a head level.
Yeah, yeah.
And from that point on, I started taking my faith much more seriously. You know, reading the Bible, getting involved at the Christian Union at university, and I spent my teenage years at Soul Survivor Watford, where I was exposed to a very vibrant faith setting, which was fantastic and really set me up for my walk of faith.
Mm. Do you have any sense of why it was that particular moment in that particular place when you were 12 that God decided to give you a deeper revelation of who he was?
You know, I have no idea. You know, I'm glad that he did. I don't know why he chose then and there, but I am grateful to those festivals, you know, whether it was New Wine with my family or later Soul Survivor on my own. I'm really grateful to them because I had many opportunities to meet with God in really powerful ways, you know, which isn't the be all and end all of faith, obviously, but it's the fantastic mountaintop moments that give you such strength for when you're then walking through the valley, because that's where stuff will grow.
Yes.
But when you take those really powerful moments of faith, that can spur you on.
Mm. Now, some people, particularly critics of the faith, would say, well, these emotional moments that people have, they're just emotions. They're just a kind of type of hysteria, or they're just an emotional outburst. But clearly for you, those moments within the broader context of your Christian faith are very important. So how do you defend and encourage us to think about those moments where perhaps you felt God very powerfully? What was happening there, do you think?
I understand why people think that. And I think quite often that is true. But I would say that those kind of encounters are proved by the subsequent faith. And the subsequent walk with God that you have. You know, if that's all you ever have, you know, those sort of jubilant moments on the mountaintop and then there's nothing else, well, that's not real, is it? And that was just a moment, that was just superficial. But when it translates into walking with God day in, day out, learning to listen to his voice, learning to follow his will and meet him in his word and serve him in the local church, then I think that is the validation for those experiences. They're not essential by any means, but I, for one, count myself lucky that I've had them. They don't happen all that often. No. And so I'm really glad for the encounters I have had.
And apart from this moment when you were 12, have there been other very specific moments where perhaps you felt God's presence very strongly, and that could have been quite an emotional moment, but perhaps also where you felt God was convicting you of something or directing you or talking to you in some way? Where there have been other very specific moments in your life like that?
Yep, there have been others in a variety of church settings. I think probably the most powerful and the most poignant for me was when I felt his call upon my life to be a writer and to use my writing for him. And just that real conviction that this was a God-given gift and it was given to me for a reason. And it's something that I should invest in and should dedicate my life to. And that was a word that I really had to accept in faith and hold on to, because when I had, you know, drafted my early novels, my initial attempts to get publication didn't succeed. And I actually had a gap of 17 years between finishing the first draft of Aura and Amilar, age 16, and then it becoming published last year. That was a long, hard road to walk, holding on to that promise that God would use this writing and that he hadn't given me this gift for no reason. So it takes a lot of faith to really hold on to a word like that from God, because life has a way of sort of beating it out of you and making you doubt it. So I really, you know, cherish that memory and would encourage others who, you know, if you feel like God has promised you something like that, then run with it and walk with it, no matter what happens, you know, even if it takes a while before you see the fruition of it.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? So from what you're saying, it sounds as if you received and were convicted by that sense of God saying he wants you to be a writer and he wants you to use your writing skills. That would have been when you were 16 or younger that you felt that. And then you've had to wait 17 years until last year to see all of that then fulfilled in terms of a publication. So what helped you to hang on to that promise over that time?
I think two things. One, it helps that I enjoy doing the writing. You know, I would do it anyway, even if I wasn't published. I'd do it for my own satisfaction. It's just jolly good fun. But secondly, I think I take real encouragement from the stories I see in the Bible of other people going through these similar situations. And one of the things I've learned through reading the Bible is that there is always a pause between the promise and the promised land, between a promise given by God and its fulfillment. So if you look at, you know, Abraham and the promise he was given of a land and a people, it took 400 years before his descendants walked into the promised land.
Yes.
And David was anointed king at a young age, but it was many, many years later through many trials that he actually realized that word and became king.
Yes.
So time and again through the Bible, we see this pattern, and it really strengthened me to see that, you know, God is faithful, even if it takes longer than you'd like.
Yes, I guess if you think about the example of David, and there are probably many other examples, it's like he had a bit of a rough time in many ways before the promise was fulfilled. So this is this issue of holding on to God's promises. So was there any way in which you were encouraged by others or by your church or by community or by other particular people as well in holding on to that promise that you felt God had given you?
Undoubtedly. Yeah. Particularly my parents really encouraged me in that belief. And I had a few really good friends around me who really believed in that promise with me. You know, they'd read some of the early drafts. They were really encouraging you know, just help give me the strength to stay the course and to keep pursuing it. And, you know, certainly my wife, Lucy, when I met her, I don't think she realized what she was getting into when she married a man who had created an entire world and spent a lot of his time there, certainly with mental energy. But she's been very good as well in helping me persevere, helping me keep moving.
That's great.
I think, you know, you do need people around you to help you stick it out.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of us, you know, give up on our dreams far too early before they've had a chance to come true.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. So just the point about don't give up on your dreams too early, I think, is a really interesting point. Okay, so when we were talking a few minutes ago, you alluded to the fact that sometimes God is present with us and it's great and we feel the emotion of it, and it can be one of those kind of mountaintop experiences. But there are also many times, most of the time perhaps, in our Christian walk, when it's just the day-to-day faithfulness of that walk and the discipline of our life with God. And sometimes things are difficult as well. Now, you've talked about how you felt God had convicted you that you should be using your gifts as a writer and exercising those gifts and using those gifts in his service. Now, the writing that you've done isn't explicitly Christian. The stories that you write, I think it's fair to say they draw on Christian themes and morals and there's that sensibility about them, but they're not explicitly Christian. So how can not just writers, but anybody who is considers themselves an artist in the broadest sense, so painters, dancers, musicians, whatever, how do we commit our artistic creations to God? How can we give to God that which he has put in us?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think God can use anything that we choose to give him. And I sometimes think that we perhaps have too narrow a definition of what it means to serve God. And we sometimes get fooled into thinking that it has to be, you know, full-time church ministry or something. Mm. And I remember getting quite frustrated at times, you know, when I was at church and listening to sometimes, you know, the altar calls and, you know, so the calls for prayer at the end of a service where they'd said, you know, if you feel, you know, convicted to go into Christian leadership, or if you feel like, you know, you want to be part of the worship team or some, or be an evangelist. And it was, you know, all this, you know, you had to be a certain type of thing to be able to use your skills for God. And I always felt frustrated, you know, why weren't they calling the writers? Why weren't they calling the artists and the poets and the, you know, whatever else you might be, the entrepreneurs and the inventors? Mm. Actually, God's given us all these gifts and we can use all of them for him. Mm. Because yes, I believe in serving the local church, but I also believe in using your gifts for God out in the world.
Sure. Definitely.
So I think, you know, commit what you do to the Lord and he will establish your plans. I think that's one of the verses in Proverbs. Mm. So for me, I don't set out to write specifically Christian material, but I do set out to honor God with what I write. And it just naturally flows through what I write because my faith is such an important and integral part of who I am. It just flows naturally into what I write. Mm. So like you say, those themes and those principles will come through. You know, principles of faith, just the sheer concept of a God who wants a relationship with you. Mm. Yes, I'm giving expression to that in a fantasy setting, in an imaginary world, but it's just the same as it is on this world, that God wants a relationship with us, that he is active in history, and that he is using people to accomplish his plans, and that we can either choose to be a part of that or work against it. And when you've got a sort of a good and evil narrative in the background as well, that throws up so many opportunities to tell gospel messages in a subtle and unobtrusive way through the stories. So yes, I'm not trying to preach the gospel in my books, but I am trying to, you know, show people what God is like. And if people can come away from my works having a clearer image of God, or even just of having a few stumbling blocks taken away, then I'll have done my job.
That's good.
But I really like the idea that the faith messages are there for those who want to see them. But for those who don't want to see them or who are oblivious to them, they're not a barrier to them either. It's not like so apparent that it's a real turnoff for anyone who is just instantaneously opposed to that for whatever reason.
So clearly writing and I suspect reading are a big part of your life. I wondered if you could tell us who were the earliest literary influences on you.
My earliest influences were definitely Tolkien. I remember reading The Hobbit as a child in my grandma's house with these sort of, you know, wooden beams and these, you know, nice lamplights at night, and just being transported to another world. And I suddenly realized that was a thing, that was possible. And obviously, as I've grown up, I've been exposed to, you know, Tolkien's, you know, almost doctrine of sub-creation, of Christians intentionally creating because they are made in the image of a creative God.
But
it was just wonderful just to see, wow, I could make my own world. And I just fell in love with that idea. Now, there have been other influences since, you know. Yes, C.S. Lewis, Stephen Lawhead is another Christian writer, but also other, you know, non-Christian writers, you know, Bernard Cornwell in terms of historical fiction. George R.R. Martin and Stephen Erickson, you know, other, you know, great fantasy writers. Lots of different influences there.
So I wondered if you could tell us what you think are the most important lessons that you've learned in life that you think that you'd want to communicate to other people. If somebody said, What's the most important thing I should remember, or the most one or two important things I should remember in life? What would that wisdom be from your point of view?
Okay, well, I'll leave it to others to judge how wise it is. But I think I kind of want to go back to something I've already touched on, but just to kind of expand it a little bit, is that, you know, don't give up on your dreams too soon. I'm a real believer, and it comes naturally to me because I am a starter finisher type person. You know, I do naturally find it easy to complete things that I start. And I know that's not true for everyone, but I do see and hear of so many people giving up on their dreams because it doesn't happen right away. And it seems to be a product of this sort of increasingly instantaneous culture that we live in, where everything is instantly available. And I just have this sense that we're getting worse and worse at waiting for things. So, you know, it takes time for things to be established, and it takes time for dreams to come true. So you have to work towards them, and you have to accept that it will take a while. And, you know, if you're not prepared to do that, you know, then you should confront that early on. You know, I love the verse in Zechariah, I believe, where he's talking about, do not despise the day of small things. You know, when they're just laying the foundation stones for that rebuilt temple after the exile. And, you know, it's easy to mock those small foundations, or the legend of Romulus and Remus, where he's laughing at the small walls of Rome when they first started out, but it builds into something bigger. But yeah, it's a real sense that you have to wait for success sometimes. And when you see other people having success, and we see others enjoying success, and we get envious and we want it for ourselves, but we don't want all the hard work that comes with it. And we don't see all the waiting and the blood, sweat and tears of those years of preparation before they reach their success. You know, whether it's that masterpiece they've created, or the Olympic medal, or the business that's finally flourishing after years of really working at it. Things take time, don't they?
They do.
And I think that's a real message that this culture needs to hear, I think, that good things are worth persevering with.
I'm reminded of the, I think it was actually a writer, the kind of, it's a bit of a gag really, a famous writer saying, who said, you know, I waited 20 years to become an overnight success, or I worked for 20 years to become an overnight success. And I think, there is that kind of steady, consistent progression, and the need for patience within that steady, consistent progression towards the big thing that you want to do. And I'm also reminded of something that one of my recent guests said, a lady called Sarah Grace, who's a psychotherapist, and she...
Yeah, I know her.
Well, you probably would know her, actually. And one of the things that she made a point of talking about was that it's very important for people to know what they really want to do, what really does stir them. I wondered if you think that can be perhaps a necessary prelude to then investing the time in the long term, that actually knowing in your heart what you really want to do then is a precursor to then doing it, not just for a week or a month or even a year, but actually over several years.
Yes, for sure. I think there are different means and paths by which people come to that realization. For me, it was quite natural. You know, I had this desire to write. You know, I saw, you know, created worlds. I got exposed to fantasy, and boom, that was it. I was hooked for life, and never looked back. I think for some people it might take longer, and it might not be quite so crystal clear. But you definitely have to realize what it is you want to do and be sure that you want to commit to it, because it will take a lot of time and it requires sacrifice as well. Well, when I'm working a full-time job and parenting two small children, it takes great intentionality to get the writing done, to make sure that I write something every day, to prioritize it, which means I can't just, you know, binge on Netflix, and I can't just, you know, spend hours scrolling through Instagram. You know, I have to be disciplined with my time. And, you know, there is joy in that, but there is also sacrifice.
So what kind of words of advice do you think you would give to your younger self? If you were speaking to your 10, 15, 20-year-old self now, what sort of thing would you be saying?
Well, the first thing I would tell my younger self is, you never know what's just around the corner. You never know when the change will come until it hits you. And you can feel like there's no end in sight. You can feel like things are going to go on unchanged forever, and the breakthrough will never come. until it does. And very often you never see it coming. And that's a real encouragement to not lose heart, to not despair. God is still working behind the scenes, and you never know what he has got prepared for you just around the corner. And I remember being vividly struck by that when I met my wife for the first time. And I was thinking, you know, I'd spent years thinking, am I ever going to meet someone? And then suddenly there she was, and you know, just completely out of the blue, round the corner, had no idea, completely blindsided by it. But again, I've never looked back, and I would just encourage my younger self to think, and I would bear witness to the fact that, you know, God has been so faithful and so generous with his blessings, but he doesn't tell you in advance how he's going to bless you. you've got to wait for it and until it gets there. Just persevere in those difficult seasons and be prepared to wait for the breakthrough, because it will come. You know, there are harder and easier seasons in life, but neither of them last. So enjoy the good seasons and persevere through the bad seasons. There's purpose in all of them. And it's easy to wish them away or spend too much time planning for the future, or, you know, going over regrets from your past, to be fully present in the moment. And one thing I've seen as a parent is that there are pros and cons to every stage in life. You know, from you know, having newborn kids to now having preschoolers and kids at school, I always think, oh, I'm going to miss that stage. But in fact, I'm too busy enjoying the good bits of the next stage. So you've got to embrace the good and the bad and just be fully present in the moment. I think that's what I'd say to my younger self. And as well, make the most of every opportunity. You know, some opportunities won't come again, so seize them with both hands. I think it's better to regret having done something than not having done something.
That's an interesting perspective, isn't it? So it is better to, it's better to have tried and it didn't work out than never to have tried at all, perhaps.
And I think that sounds a bit cliche when we put it like that. But I think, I found that to be true. You know, my greater regrets are the things I didn't do, not the things I did do that didn't necessarily work out, or I'm not the most proud of looking back.
We've touched on this a little bit already, but I wondered if there was advice that you would give, not so much to yourself, but to the world. If there was one piece of advice that if you could just give everybody in the world that piece of advice in one moment, what would you be saying to people?
I think it would be put your trust in something reliable. I think there's so much changing at the moment. There's so much uncertainty.
Yes.
You really need something to hold on to. And, you know, I was thinking about this the other day, and just Psalm 62 verse 2 came to me, where it says, truly, he is my rock and my salvation. Speaking of God, obviously, he is my fortress. I shall never be shaken. Perhaps that's a word in season for people right now, whether it's Christians to encourage them to keep walking with their faith, and perhaps also to non-Christians to encourage them that there is a source of certainty out there. There is something reliable in which you can put your trust when, you know, pandemics and all kinds of upheavals and climate change have shown us that the things we think are permanent and secure are not perhaps as permanent and secure as we thought. And things can change, and the familiar comforts of life can change. But there is one thing that doesn't change, and that is that God is there, and that he is faithful, and his love is unfailing.
So I just for context, I guess I would say to people listening to this, so we're recording this in November 2020, so we are in the year, hopefully it's just a year, of the pandemic, the virus, and certainly in this country, we're talking in the UK, in England, in the UK, and we are going through a second lockdown at the moment. Much of the rest of the world is facing this at the moment. So perhaps those words about the stability and dependence of God are particularly appropriate and worth reflecting on just at the moment. I wanted to ask as well, just if you were speaking to somebody who was just maybe searching for God, wasn't sure whether there was a God or not, just thinking maybe I should explore this a little bit. So somebody just a bit uncertain, but maybe wanting to find out a little bit more, what would you be saying to those sorts of people?
Well, on a very practical level, I would encourage them to check out an Alpha course. Get on an Alpha course. It's fantastic. You won't regret it, because it's a great opportunity and a great forum, a safe place in which to ask your questions and meet, you know, like-minded people who may have some similar questions as you. So, you know, you're not going to be suddenly just confronted with a scary church situation where everyone seems to be super spiritual or what have you, but you can meet fellow seekers, if you like. So I'd really encourage you to check out Alpha. But I would also say on a less practical level, I would say you don't have to have it all together. You don't have to be perfect for God to accept you, and you don't have to earn his love. So don't let any shame or self-doubt stop you from seeking him. Some people may or may not be aware of the parable of the prodigal son in Luke 15, where, you know, he's coming back to his father and he's worrying about, you know, the mistakes he's made and the shame he's got for stupid decisions and having run away from his father. And they're all groundless, because when he gets to his father, the father just embraces him, no questions asked, and just welcomes him back. And it's just so pleased to have him there and to renew that relationship. And just, I just want to say to people that God is desperate for a relationship with you. And it's on God's terms, not yours. You don't have to buy it. You don't have to earn it. You don't have to be at a certain standard. You know, as it says in Revelation 3:20, he's standing at the door knocking. And all you have to do is open the door and let him in.
So what you're saying there, for some people listening to this, might seem quite countercultural. And so there might be people listening to this who would think, well, actually, I believe that I have to earn things. I have to earn respect or earn money or earn love, or that you don't get something for nothing. How can it be that we can engage with God in a way where we haven't had to earn something from him or justify ourselves to him?
That's the core of the gospel message, isn't it? And it is countercultural. It does run against the grain. And I know that that trips people up sometimes, because they feel like they have to earn it. But that's what grace is. Grace is a gift that you don't have to earn, and you never could earn. You know, what the Bible teaches us is that, you know, we can never be good enough for God on our own terms. But what we can do is accept the freely given gift of Jesus's righteousness and his redemption. And I think, yes, that is something perhaps some people will have to wrestle with, but it is fundamentally good news, because it is just so freeing, and, you know, takes away all the pressure of trying to prove yourself and trying to earn it for yourself.
And the other potentially countercultural thing you mentioned just there, I'd like you to unpack a little bit, is this idea of having a relationship with God. Surely we kind of worship God and he's a distant being. How does that work? How can we actually have a relationship with God?
That's a good question. I think the whole Bible is the story of humanity's relationship with God, and of lots of different individual people making up that story, having a relationship with God. And I fundamentally believe God is not some remote deity in the sky that we worship and venerate, but can never approach. The God I see painted in scripture is of a personal, loving God who wants to talk to us, who wants to share his plans for us, you know, who wants us to speak to him in prayer and wants to speak to us through his word. And this is a loving, intimate God. And, you know, I can read off any number of Bible verses, but, you know, I think of Zephaniah 3:17 when it says, you know, the Lord is mighty to save and he will delight over you with singing. You know, this is a passionate God. He's a relational God, you know, in relationship, God Father and God the Father, Son and Holy Spirit. But he also wants a relationship with us. And he wanted it so badly that he sent his son, Jesus Christ, to die for us, so that we could enter into that relationship with God. So it's not religion, it's a relationship.
You make it sound as if anyone could just literally call out to God and talk to him. Is that a thing? Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I think, you know, you'll need to get into the word. You need to read the Bible to understand who it is you're calling out to and what they might be saying, what he might be saying in return. But anyone at any stage in life can reach out to God. God, you know, as that verse in Revelation said, he's already at the door. He's already knocking. And all you have to do is reach out to him. And I believe that anyone who genuinely reaches out in faith to God will meet him.
Okay. So we're coming to the end of our conversation now. We've referred a couple of times to your writing and to your books. So I wondered if you could just take a moment to tell us then about these books that you've published, that you say it took 17 years for you to get from the point of writing a first draft through to the three books that are published now. Tell us a little bit more about those books and those stories.
Sure. So the book is called Auron Amilar, which might sound unfamiliar. It's actually an Elvish, a couple of Elvish words that mean the mountain of high magic. And it is set in a fantasy world called Ashtron, which I have created and built from scratch. And the essence of the story is that there is a mysterious mage lord, Caluthiar, who sends out an invitation to a tournament. Hmm. And he invites heroes and wanderers from the length and breadth of Ashtron to come and compete for power unimaginable. And suddenly the old legends are awakening again, this ancient home of wizards that people thought was lost forever, suddenly is coming back alive, and people's imaginations are stirred, and people want to compete for these ancient powers that they think are available. Mm. And it might not be quite what they think, but certainly it triggers a series of quests for people to seek the mountain. And so my books, book one, The Court of the Mountain, follows a couple of those heroes as they start their quest towards the mountain, an adventure that takes many twists and turns along the way, and they quickly up to their necks in danger. And then book two, Rite of Passage, is about that ongoing quest and the detours they have to go to in order to win through to the mountain, to rescue old allies and to earn their passage. And then book three, just recently released, Power Unimaginable, is the culmination of the trilogy. Our heroes have reached the mountain, the contestants have assembled, and the mountain is now beckoning them, this mysterious place of power and peril. And it's going to be it'll be a fantastic read, and I can promise an explosive ending. So you don't necessarily have to like fantasy. It is high fantasy if you want to put a name on it, but if you like a good adventure story, then it'll be for you. And it will make for great winter reading.
And that's ebook format, paperback. It's available anywhere and everywhere, really, isn't it? I think you could go into your local bookshop.
It's available at all good booksellers.
Sure.
It's on the Kindle store in ebook format. But you can also buy the books directly from the author, from me. So go to my website, worldofastrom.com. That's worldofastrom.com. Or follow at World of Ashtron on social media. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So check it out. I'd love for you to read it.
Great. Okay. Is there anything that you want to say before we finish?
No, I just thank you for the invitation. It's been great to talk to you this afternoon. And I hope some of what we've touched upon will be of encouragement to your listeners.
I'm sure it will be. And thank you for your time. It's been great to have a chat with you about your work, about the things you've learned, about your experience with God. And don't give up on your dreams too early, I guess, is one of the big things I'm taking away from this conversation. Okay, thanks again for your time, Michael. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to the Testimony Podcast. You can subscribe to the Testimony Podcast on all of the major podcast distributors and follow us on Twitter at TestimonyCast and Instagram at Testimony Podcast. If you want to find out more about the Christian faith and connect with someone to talk about your experiences or answer your questions, just go to www.christianity.org.uk from wherever you are in the world. That's www.christianity.org.uk. I look forward to sharing more of the stories that matter from people of faith with you soon. Until then, thank you for listening and goodbye.